This is 4:55 on Wednesday, October 12th.
Well, I started the video recording, but I didn't start the audio recording. The Chapter 4 assignment is due, as you see, on Friday next week, so there's still time to do that, and we will be handing out the second project the middle of next week. So, and it will have to do with routing, which we'll be talking about between now and then. Any other sort of logistics or housekeeping issues related to the class? Last time we were talking, we were talking about DHCP and how hosts get their address from a DHCP server. And there are a bunch of slides here. I'm not going to go through them in detail. You can look at them. It's pretty straightforward. You know, the client says, I need a broadcasting that says, I need an IP address. Somebody on the network, a DHCP server responds saying, I'm your DHCP server, and here's a likely candidate. The client tries it out to make sure there are no conflicts. And if it's happy with it, it requests it and gets permission to use it for a period of time. And so that was the part that I hadn't gotten to say last time, was that the client gets permission to use the address for a period of time. And the name for this concept is a lease on the IP address. So the client is told, you're allowed to use this address for, oh, what do we use around here? Like 15 minutes or something, I think, is what we use around here. You can, once you've been assigned an IP address, you can use it for 15 minutes. Well, that doesn't sound very useful. What do? Well, before the 15 minutes are up, you ask for it again. You say, can I keep using it? And the server almost always says, yeah, go ahead. So why do we do this? Well, IP addresses on especially university networks, where people are moving around all the time, are kind of a scarce commodity, right? So if all 17,000 students on campus sort of lay through the same space and need IP addresses at different times of day, and we have /22 networks, how many hosts are supported by a /22 network? Well, 22 is the number of bits in the network part, which means there are 10 left over for the host part, and that's 2 to the 10th, which is 1024. Right? You're computer scientists. These numbers ought to be getting into your brains by the time you're seniors. 1024, and two of those are special. So 1,020. Anyway, 17,000 students circulating through the same space that only supports 1,022 different addresses, probably not going to work very well. The leasing mechanism allows the server to recover the addresses and reuse them when a client goes away. If a client stops asking for an address, then that address is free for the server to assign to somebody else. And that's why we have leases. Okay? Yeah?
So it keeps something new like a handshake?
So the protocol, go look at the DHCP protocol. It's can I have an IP address? A likely candidate. You try it out to see there's no conflict, and then you request it, and then you're given the lease. Okay. What? No, it's not ARP. It's DHCP. Okay. We'll get to ARP in the next chapter. All right. Let's do some of these Clicks questions, and I think I just gave you the answer to the first one, so isn't that nice? Thank you. I have to wonder if some people are present in the room, given the answers I'm seeing. Does anybody want to reread the question and submit a different answer? I mean, I'm seeing many, many correct answers. But I'm seeing very strange answers. How many bits make up the subnet part of the address? Not the host part, the subnet part. And not how many hosts can there be or anything like that. How many bits? Okay. Well, the notation is very explicit. The /22 says 22 bits make up the subnet. That's all there is to it. Okay? So not 1,024 and not 1,022 and not 10 and not... Okay, 22. Simple enough. All right, are we tuned into this? How many bits make up the host part of the address? Mostly good. How does it work? There are 32 bits overall. 22 of them are the subnet part, so there are 10 left over for the host part. All right. Now it gets trickier. If a host CIDR IP address is given as the same thing, is 13.2.3.137 a valid address on the same subnet? So let's talk about this one before you answer. The subnet part is first. There are 22 bits worth of that. Where does that 22-bit boundary fall in this notation? In which byte does it fall? The third one, right? So somewhere in there, there's a boundary that says, you know, everything to the left of this is part of the subnet part and everything to the right. Where does it fall in that byte? 2 bits from the right. There are 2 bits to the right of it and 6 bits to the left of it. Okay? So, is that enough information to answer the question?
Apparently not. Oh. Well, come on. Refresh. Apparently not. Let's go back.
Okay. So, how do you tell if they're on the same subnet? They agree in all of the subnet bits. Right? So, 13 agrees, 2 agrees, 64 and 137 are definitely part of the host part, so that's not relevant. So the only question is 3, is the value 3 sort of represented entirely in the host part, or is it partly in the subnet part? Well, it's 2 bits, right? And so we said the last 2 bits were part of the host part, so indeed this value agrees on the 6 bits that are part of the subnet. And so yes, this is part of the same subnet. Guess what? Exam question. Yes, sir.
You're saying that if 3, if that value was larger than, if you were represented by 2 bits, then it would be heavily into the host?
Into the subnet part, yes. Okay. So if this were anything that was four or bigger,
right.
then it's in the subnet part, and the subnet part no longer agrees.
Right.
Okay, so it would be a different subnet. Okay?
I hope everybody noticed what I said about that. Guess what? Exam question. All right.
See, we did. I talked about this. How many usable host addresses are there on that subnet?
Still slash 22. Yeah,
I think everybody's starting to get it now, right? There are 10 bits, that's 1024, two are reserved, leaving D as the answer, 1022.
All right, we're going to shift gears and ask about something else.
The time to live field, we've talked about that, is part of which header?
Okay.
Most people are answering B, which is correct. If you're answering A or C, I would encourage you to think about why you're answering A or C. A and C are what? At what level? Transport. And what is transport associated with? Endpoints. Okay? If you remember back to those diagrams about the layers of the stack throughout the network, the routers don't even have transport. Okay, so how are they going to interpret time to live? So,
lots of clues about what the right answer is if you will think about it and try to respond that way instead of just responding from rote. Okay, a few people are saying they're lost at this point. I'm going to ask one more of these, and then
we'll come back and see what's going on. Okay, Telnet protocol may send a keystroke of a user in a terminal. That's one byte at a time to the host in a separate TCP segment, right? Because you type something and you want to get it back. What fraction of data carried on the network is overhead? So what is overhead? Everything that's not the useful data itself, right? So the useful data here is one byte. How much overhead is there?
Okay, everybody's answered.
Good job, about 98%. There are 20 bytes of IP header, 20 bytes of TCP header, and one byte of data, so that means 40 over 41 is the overhead, and that's about 97.5%. something more than 0.5%. So about 98%. And that's understating it. Because we haven't talked about link layers yet, which are another big chunk. So,
One byte at a time, as you saw in the... I mean, hopefully what you saw when you ran one byte at a time on the project was that everything else went really fast, and that one paused briefly. It didn't pause very long, but it paused briefly. But when you moved to the 1K byte at a time, you couldn't notice any pause at all. Yeah. So one byte at a time is not a good thing, unless you really need to, like for Telnet, right? Because with Telnet, you're typing, you want the characters to come back as soon as you type them, and so that works. Okay. Like I said, a few people are saying they're lost about these questions about CIDR notation. What can I do to help? Yeah. Oh, okay. Okay. So there are 10 bits, right? 2 to the 10th is 1024, okay, and 2 are reserved and not available to be used for hosts, leaving 1022.
2 are reserved.
The highest address is reserved broadcast, and the lowest address is reserved for something that's sort of close to broadcast. Okay, so those can't be used for hosts. Everything else. I hope that's all the confusion.
Cool. All right, so here's another thinking question. Darn, we have to think.
So, given that there's 98% overhead when doing this, why do we prefer Telnet instead of UDP, even though UDP would have significantly less overhead? I mean, it isn't why do we prefer. Why does Telnet use UDP? It isn't a question of preference. It actually does use.
Okay, good job.
I'm seeing good answers. Essentially, we want reliable in-order delivery of the bytes with Telnet. It would be nice if you typed LF into your Telnet session and instead it did SF or something like that. You wouldn't want that happening. So
reliable in-order byte directory. Good show. The question has to be asked in terms of what do you want to do as to which protocol to choose. Good. Let's go on then and talk about
the next thing, which is we've talked with DHCP about how hosts get their IP addresses using either manual configuration or by asking this DHCP query and being told their address, net mask, default gateway, host name maybe, all kinds of information can be done from DHCP. But how did the DHCP server know what subnet address to give to the server? Where did that come from? How did somebody get that? And the answer to that is that this is an administrative function, largely. It's sort of delivered automatically, but the real question here is, how does the world get divvied up into different pieces of subject? And there's an administrative authority called the
Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers,
that started out having all 4 billion addresses. It didn't actually, because it didn't exist way back then, but think of it that way. Started out having all 4 billion addresses available in the 32-bit space, and it started handing out chunks of that to different regions of the world. So we wanted to do this geographically because traffic going, it's very nice if the prefixes are the same, because then the routers that we saw have this longest prefix matching idea. So if the prefix is the same for a whole bunch of things, then you don't need to have it routing table entries for everything below it. So sort of geographically hand out chunks of numbers to regional authorities, who then hand out subspaces of that, right? And when I say subspaces, I'm just saying there's a prefix, here's a longer prefix, here's a longer prefix, and so on and so forth. Get handed out to internet service providers, who then hand them out to their customers. And that's sort of the administrative process by which that is done. And the result is that, look at this. So here's an ISP's block, and let's say it's handing out addresses to this blue line here should not go all the way. Should not go all the way to the end there. It should stop after the 1. Because it's a /20 network. Right? So 20 bits is 8, 16, 20 right there. The blue line should stop there. So everything to the right of that is subnet as far as the ISP, is host as far as the ISP is concerned. But it's then going to hand out different subspaces of that to different organizations. Okay? And they get /23. So, okay? So upstream of this ISP, we only need a single routing entry to point all of the traffic going to all of these organizations to this ISP. And then the ISP's routers will have the longer prefixes, or have the longer routing table entries that divert the traffic to the different customers.
And this sort of says what I just said, right? That we can do that, we can do that, fine.
Now, 4 billion addresses, roughly, available, 6 plus billion people in the world, telephones, laptops, tablets, desktop computers, multiple computers per person, not enough IP. It's been recognized since the early 1990s as being a problem. And IP version 6 was the main proposal to solve it. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more later. But the problem with IP version 6 is that it's sort of a global change. Everybody has to switch to using it. Or let's just say, not everybody, but a lot of people have to switch to using it before it becomes a useful replacement for IP version 4, which is what we're using today. Meanwhile, something that was much more locally controllable came along in the form of the idea of what's called network address translation, NAT. And the reason it's locally controllable is because you can have a network, no further connectivity to the broader internet, a gateway, and the rest of the internet, and just by doing something on this gateway, you can start to use a whole bunch of different devices out here in your private network using only a single IP address outward to the network. Address information. Right? And so it's a local solution, right? You could, you know, I think at my house I've got probably 20 different IP addresses assigned for various things at different times, and one single IP version for network service, all of them. How does it work? Well, network address translation. It's just what it says. When a computer here sends a packet out through this gateway, somehow that IP packet gets translated to being something different that only refers to this so-called public IP address. The private IP addresses stay private on the network. All right. So that's the first part of it, is that the source IP address in these packets going out gets translated to be this. And the other thing that's done is that the port numbers on these devices here get translated to port numbers on this device here, and it maintains a table so that when it gets traffic coming in for a particular port number, it knows which device to send it to. So it's just a big lookup table.
Let's see, I think there's another picture of this. We talked about why. Yeah.
So here's the scheme. In outgoing datagrams, you replace the source IP address and port number, which came from the interior node, whatever it was, with the gateway's IP address, and some new port number that the gateway just picks to be convenient for it. Doesn't matter what it is. And when clients respond to that IP address and new port number, the gateway will look that up in a table and say, oh, that really was supposed to go here. Pretty simple idea.
And the IPv6 version 6 folks hate this, and network purists hate this,
because it is really taking what is supposed to be a network device and making it look into the transport layer headers, right? It has to look at the port numbers in order to do what it does.
This is just an example of what the packets are looking like. You need to go look at that yourself. I'm not going to talk through it, but it just does what it said on the previous slide.
Okay. So network purists hate it. It violates the end-to-end argument. IPv version 6 advocates hate it because it reduces the demand for switching to IP version 6. Okay. And in large part, that's why we haven't switched, is because this NAT idea came along. It's actually worse than I said, in that the routers are now looking at the transport layer. There are some application protocols that contain IP addresses in the application protocol as well. Right, not just transport, but the actual application protocol. And to successfully get through NAT devices with those protocols, the NAT device actually has to look into the application protocol and translate it. Or
the application protocol has to be aware of the NAT and somehow figure out what the NATed addresses are going to be and stick those in the protocol. Okay, so it's really messy, and this is a particular problem with things like voice over IP protocols that were designed with the network addresses as part of the application protocol, and gets messy. All right, so that's NAT. The other thing about NAT is, what if you have a server on your network over here, and you want the public to be able to reach it? Well, everything I've talked about so far says that the way this works is when a machine here makes an outgoing connection, all this stuff gets set up, the transmission tables. But servers don't make outgoing connections, do they? They accept incoming connections. And so to overcome that, I have to statically configure our tables here to say, when somebody contacts this address on a particular port number, that is supposed to be going to that server. And your home NAT boxes have the ability to do this. How many people have set up a server at home using a NAT box? Anybody? Yeah? A few? Okay. Now, there's another feature of this that I do want to point out, which is, and it's sort of related to this bug, but it's just another side of the same technology. One really pretty nice thing about using NAT in this role is that the hosts over here are just not accessible on the internet. Right. Unless you could figure a static path from a static path to this address and some port to some other computer, that computer just is not reachable. Right. So it can't be bugged by attempts to sort of log into it or attack it with network traffic. And that's actually, I think, a pretty nice feature of this. It's very simple. You could implement a firewall. We'll talk about firewalls in the security part, but you could implement something called a firewall here that would have that same behavior, but that would be more work. With NAT, it's just sort of automatic that protection happens. Okay? Anybody look at the logs on your machine? How often they're attacked by things coming in over the network? I do. I typically want SSH servers running on my home machine, on one home machine, so that I can get into it. And you look at the logs about how many times a minute that somebody tries to make a connection to that. It's just astounding. All the time. Somebody making a connection to that, putting in some username, putting in some password, and seeing if they get a connection. Always. And so, there's also a very effective strategy against that, is to simply change the right here. So instead of the standard SSH port of 22, when you get something here on port 22, you forward it there. No, when you get something here on some other random port, even something obvious like 222, all that traffic goes away. Nobody actually tries alternative ports for SSH attacks, even though it would be an obvious thing to do. I don't get it. Why aren't they more creative? But they aren't. So it's a useful thing. Okay. All right.
you can look at this. I want to talk about ICMP and IMP version 6. So ICMP,
the Internet Control Message Protocol. These are messages that are sent sort of by the network layer to hosts and other elements of the network layer to tell them that something fishy is going on. Not fishy, that's the wrong sense. Something unusual has happened, something unexpected. And we think of it as being we think of it as being part of the network layer because it's sort of the management of the network, but still the messages are carried in IP datagrams. So remember that picture early on in this chapter where I had IP and I had ICMP sort of in the same layer. That's this idea. So what kinds of things can you do with ICMP? Well, if you're familiar with ping, the idea of just sending a packet to a host and seeing if it responds, that's ICMP. Other things that happen are destination host and network unreachable, right? So errors. So I've tried to send something to a host and for some reason or other a router along the way has decided that packet can't be delivered. Destination protocol unreachable, that's kind of unusual. Destination port unreachable, a host at the end will say this. If you send a packet to a port on a host and that port is not listening, it can respond with port unreachable. Not clear to me what the difference between unknown and unreachable might be. I haven't looked that up. Echo request goes with echo reply. The one that I wanted to talk about is TTL expired. Right? I said that the TTL field gets counted down as a packet makes every hop. If it ever reaches zero, it's this ICMP message that's sent back to the originator. There's another one that should be on here.
Maybe not to IP version 6.
Okay, so traceroute. I think I showed you traceroute at the beginning of class, right? So here's how it works. We set the time to live field to 1 and send 3 packets to the destination. What happens? They don't get there. It wouldn't have to be on the same link. It's not. So the router that they reached replies back and says, TTL expired. What do you learn from that? You learn the address of the router. Okay? So that then the traceroute prints out that information and goes on to the next set of probes where the time to live is 2. Now they pass through this router and get to this one, and TTL expired, respond, and so we get back the addresses of all the routers along the path to the final destination. And if you so in Windows, it's trace RT. So why the long pauses? Trace RT without any flags actually does what's called a reverse DNS lookup on each name, and when it can't get an answer, it pauses. I mean, it works hard to do that. So, but you get a sense from the names sometimes about where things are. So, my goodness.
here's www.eecs.wsu.org. Yes. Here's the firewall that EECS runs. Here are two IP addresses that are part of what's called private IP address space. They're not actually routable addresses on the public internet, although they may be routable within a within an enterprise, as apparently they are here. And then the gateway for the network that my machine happens to be on. Okay, so you get a sense of how things are. Let's do a more interesting one. Still the long timeouts for the unresolvable ones. Oh, interesting.
Notice that it changed. The second hop here is different, or the third hop is different than it was there. Oh, even the second hop is different. So WSU is connected to the internet through something called the Washington K20 net. That's what these are. And you get Spokane, Seattle. This looks like Seattle. That's some unresolvable addresses. Interesting. Looks like we actually talked to a Google web server that's in Seattle, probably. Just out of curiosity, what's 1E100 as a floating point number? Anybody heard of this? It's 10 to the 100th power. Anybody heard of this number? That's a Google. Right? So Google took its name from this number, and then they went out and registered this number as a DNS name. Well, since I kept you late last time, I'm going to let you go less early this time. And next time we talk about IPv6.